taking place to really draw gender inequity, health care, tie all those issues together around financial literacy and financial education. And I have an ask to get your question ready. We'll have a brief question and answer session after our next speaker. So with that, I'd like to introduce John Holbrein. He's the founder, chairman, and CEO of Project Hope, America's first nonprofit social investment banking organization. John describes himself as a philanthropic entrepreneur and businessman focused on empowerment. In practice, this means John's extraordinarily busy, combining nonprofit work throughout the U.S. through Operation Hope. His global nonprofit work is actually through Hope Global Initiatives, and extensive work in public policy and increasing his work as a thought leader around the issues of poverty and access to financial literacy. In January 2008, John was appointed Vice Chairman of the President's Council on Financial Literacy by U.S. President George W. Bush. He also served on the Global Agenda Council for the World Economic Forum as an advisor on financial literacy and financial empowerment. Seeing that former U.S. President Bill Clinton describes John in his book, Giving, as a 41-year-old whirlwind of ideas and action, I am certain that everyone is highly anticipating some compelling and insightful remarks from John. With that, John, please come and enlighten us. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm sorry, I'm from the black church. In the black church, we have seek and respond. So I'll try this one more time. Good morning.
Good morning.
Very good. I have a particularly strong voice here on my right. I'm honored to be here with you today. By the way, I will turn on the wireless mic if I happen to leave the podium, so no problem. Honored to be with you today. Good presentation. The UN does good and important work. I've been to China several times. I've been to Dalian and to Tianjin back just as early as September for the World Economic Forum. Of course, been to Shanghai. And I've been here to Beijing. But it was a long time ago that I was here in Beijing. So I've been reading in the newspapers the last few years about Beijing's and China's advantage in the world and what supposedly it didn't do so well. I think one of the things we need to do in our time together is to radically reimagine our possibilities and our opportunities for financial literacy. And so I like making sure that starts with me. So I had a perception about China. Low-cost products, and frankly, not necessarily very sophisticated low-cost products with not necessarily sophisticated but hard-working local labor. And so I went to the Silk Mart, yesterday, and I was radically reimagined. I found people who spoke better English than I did amongst the merchants I'm talking about. I found extraordinary quality of service. I found extraordinary quality of products. My Chinese colleague was negotiating the price for me, I found that these individuals were financially literate. They understood the price, they understood their costs, and they could, on the spot, negotiate the price that they thought they could sell their product for and still make a profit. I also saw cooperation. When I gave my credit card, and again, I hadn't assumed, Brian, that I could use a credit card in the mart. I figured it would be cash. If you go to places in America where there are mart environments, it would be mostly a cash environment. They said, no, which credit card would you like us to take? MasterCard, Visa, American Express. And when one merchant didn't have the credit card provision, the merchant next door would cooperate with them for a small fee to commute that transaction. What does that all this have to do with you in this conference? Well, I believe the financial literacy has to be relevant, and it has to be aspirational, and it has to advance the state of people's lives. I am proud to say that I trusted this system I found at the Silk Mart yesterday. I gave them my credit card. I walked away with no product. I was told that my suits would be ready this morning, that a tailor would show up at my house, at my hotel, sometime this evening. Well, about midnight, no tailor. Started to become concerned. Had no phone number. About 12:35, the tailor showed up, measured me, and about 7 this morning, the suit that I am wearing today and the tie that I'm wearing today showed up at my hotel. And I must tell you, this is first-class Chinese product. So I think that we've got to radically reimagine the possibilities for the future. I am also proud to say that not only did Chinese entrepreneurs make the suit, but a young African-American entrepreneur from South Central Los Angeles made the shirt that I'm wearing with the suit. He's a success story for Operation Hope. Let me now, before I launch into my formal remarks, let me recognize my friends at Citi, which we're proud to be a global partner, my friends at Financial Times, and my new friends at Pearson, who have graciously put together this summit. My relationship with Citi goes back, almost a decade. I remember we wanted to start an office in Harlem, New York, and former President Bill Clinton was going to be our partner, but we had no resources, we had no financial resources, so we went to Citigroup and asked for a commitment of $1 million and 1,000 volunteers to teach children financial literacy in Harlem. And Citigroup responded, "We're honored that you have the President of the United States, and we're honored that you want to do this in Harlem, but we are a prudent financial service firm. We understand you're asking for $1 million and 1,000 volunteers. How about $25,000 and 8 volunteers?" That was not the response I wanted to hear. But through trust and cooperation and providing quality service on our side and a quality product, and a commitment to the long-term relations, the same, by the way, qualities I saw in the merchant yesterday, the relationship with Citi and Operation Hope has grown to a relationship that is substantial, is global, and today Operation Hope has served more than 1 million people. What do I mean by radically reimagine our possibilities? The first thing I mean is that we must look at rainbows after storms. You cannot have a rainbow without a storm first. That's a scientific fact. We have a storm, an economic storm, that's brewing in our global economy right now. And we have to not just look at the problems and the challenges of that, and I think that this is our time, by the way. For the financial education and financial literacy movement, this is our time, like no time in the history of the modern world. Let me come back to that and frame what I call the 5 P's. One, the first P is perspective, and I'm going to deal with these in a little detail before I wrap up my comments. Perspective. The perspective on financial education must change. 2, policy. There must be a global policy around financial literacy, of course, done at the national, state, and provincial levels, but we must have some agreement around the globe around policy around financial literacy. It must change. Products must change. Products and financial service companies must change. Again, I'll deal with this in some detail. Programs and the training models must change. And most importantly, how we deal with the people that have been impacted by the policies and the products and the programs that we talk about here today have to be dealt with dignity, respect, and most importantly, we have got to focus on what I call their aspirations and a sense of empowerment. Let me say that I know something about reimagining. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles, and I grew up in Compton, California. This is personal to me. My mom and my dad were brilliant people, and they worked really hard. But my mother and my father never could get together on money. The number one reason for divorce in America, and my guess is the number one reason for friction between families around the world, is the issue of money. It's not an American issue, it's a global issue. We're not human beings having a spiritual experience, we are spiritual beings having a human experience. My mom wanted to send my brother to college. She had saved her life savings, about $4,000 US, to send my brother to college. We owned, at that time, a gas station, an 8-unit apartment building, our own home, a cement contracting business, home manufacturing, and a nursery, a place to take care of children. We could make it, but we couldn't keep it. We didn't understand, like the merchant understood yesterday, about financial literacy. And so, while they loved each other, they divorced over money. I'm coming down from the stage because you have to come down from the stage in your businesses, in your programs, with your policies, and in your lives to relate to real people in real ways, and ways that really magnify their reality. My mom and dad divorced over money. My dad went on to lose that 8-unit apartment building, the gas station, the nursery, and our home. I didn't say his home. My dignified, amazing father, who was an entrepreneur, because of that I was an entrepreneur, a businessman, didn't understand money, and he was too proud to admit he didn't understand money. There are taboos around the world that we don't talk about. One of these taboos is money. We've got to stop teaching financial literacy as if it's a math equation. It is not a math equation. Money is very personal to people. It's very emotional to people. And they're ashamed to admit they don't understand it. My dad didn't understand money, and he never talked about it with his wife, my mom. And so my mother went one way, my dad went another. My dad asked this question of the mortgage broker who came to the house. It was no bankers, it was a mortgage broker. What's the payment, he asked. Now I'm going to let that sit in for a moment because it's the wrong question. What's the payment? You never ask what the payment is when there's an interest rate attached. Now that's not a poor person's issue. That's not an African-American issue. This global economic crisis that we're dealing with today is in large part because middle class individuals in the United States, middle class individuals in the United Kingdom, middle class individuals in Europe, middle class individuals even in Asia and the Middle East and Latin America, many have asked what's the payment and not what's the interest rate. And the global economic crisis at its core, you take the issue of fraud, misrepresentation, investor speculation, greed, you push those issues to the side. At the center of this global economic crisis, which has caused more than $2 trillion in U.S. assets, assets based on U.S. valuations, to come off the balance sheets of financial institutions, at the center of this is a global financial illiteracy epidemic. People are massively financially illiterate. Let me give you a couple statistics. The U.S. economy is a $14 trillion economy, U.S., $14 trillion. That's a third of the world economy. The U.S. consumer, well, before I get to that, when I was here in September, some of my colleagues from around the world at the World Economic Forum Summit, not just Chinese, but my friends from Europe and other places, were almost joyous that America was having these problems economically. But I had to remind them that we are all interconnected. So the $14 trillion economy I just mentioned, a third of the world economy is the U.S. But what drives the U.S. economy? The consumer. 70%, Andrew, 70% of the U.S. economy is consumer-driven. Here's a shocking statistic. 70% of U.S. consumers live paycheck to paycheck. 70% of U.S. consumers live paycheck to paycheck. If we're 70% of the U.S. economy, the consumer, That means the consumer is 25% of the world economy. What does that have to do with you? That means when we stop buying in the U.S., you stop building in China. I repeat, when we stop buying in the U.S., you stop building in China. I repeat one more time. When we stop buying in the U.S., you stop building in China. What statistically does that mean? The Chinese government recently issued this statistic. From January of this year, 67,000 factories closed in China. Did you hear that? I didn't say 67. I didn't say 6,700. 67,000 factories closed here in this robust, amazing economy called China. That's directly tied to the global slowdown in consumer spending. We think the banking crisis is a problem. If you have a global consumer crisis, when consumers lack confidence and make decisions and choices, and they stop closing their wallets, it's going to be a ripple effect around the world. Back to my story. In 1992, we had a riot in Los Angeles, the Rodney King riots. Most people saw this as a bad thing. I saw it as an opportunity. We need to make free enterprise and capitalism work for the poor and to empower the poor. So I founded Operation Hope with a small budget and a big vision to change the world. And Mark, everybody told me I was crazy and they said it would never work. I called it a nonprofit investment bank. And they said, nonprofit investment bank. That's an oxymoron, and John, you're a moron. I hope that translated. They said it would never work. We had a $61,000 budget in 1992, a vision to change the world and one employee. Today we're in every major community in the United States. We're in six cities in South Africa. We have raised $500 million U.S. to empower the poor. We have about 400 private sector companies, Citi, Bank of America, Deutsche Bank, Wells Fargo, a range of, it's easier to tell you who's not a partner than to tell you who is. We have about 3,000 nonprofit partners, many schools, I'll get to that in a moment, and 100 government partners from both sides of the political aisle. In my position as Vice Chairman of the President's Council, I will serve President Bush and President Obama into 2010 because this issue is not partisan. You cannot eradicate poverty on partisan lines. I would often tell people, it's not about the Republican Party in the U.S. or the Democratic Party, it's about the Get It Done Party. And we just need to be about the business of getting it done. We've served 1 million people, converting cash customers to banking customers. In America, you might not think there's poverty in America. 40 million people, we only have 300 million. I know that's small for China. But you have about that many middle class. But we have 300 million people driving a third of the world economy. Well, 40% of, or more than 10% of the U.S. population have no bank account. 40 million people in the U.S. have no bank account in the richest country in the world. That's more than the population of Canada. And I know there are delegates here from Canada. I think that there's a problem when more people don't have a bank account that didn't have the right to vote in 1962 in the United States. More people don't have a bank account that didn't have the right to vote in 1962. A bank account should be a universal human right because that is the way in which we get to free enterprise, capitalism, ownership, and opportunity, and like the guy who made this suit, entrepreneurship. So what we've converted cash customers into banking customers, renters into homeowners, small business dreamers into small business owners and entrepreneurs, moving people up and out of poverty. The only nonprofit in America to build a bank branch and sell it to a bank. We run Operation Hope like a business, but let me get to that in the Q&A section. Now let me go back to perspective. I think that after this global economic crisis, the first impact of this wears off. When your economic pockets of banks and government stop burning, when these problems stop being issues of survival for institutions, the next question that the world's consumers will ask is how do we make sure this never happens again? How do we make sure this never happens again? That is a massive, systemic, vertically integrated strategy of financial literacy, education, and empowerment. When people know better, they do better. We need to launch what I call a global civil rights movement, not civil rights, silver rights, S-I-L-V-E-R, economic empowerment. In South Africa, there were issues recently supposedly tied to foreigners and foreigners coming across the border from Zimbabwe into South Africa. That was not about foreigners. That was about poverty. And
most problems around the world, when you reduce them, become about poverty. I know China wants to keep its annual growth rate above 6% so that you can maintain a level of social stability. These financial literacy issues are tied to issues of policy. So now that I've framed the global economic issue, let me also say that I met with Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve governors about 2 months ago. And I said to them this: if 95% of Americans were financially literate, and this crisis is rippling around the world, if 95% were financially literate, the crisis would have a floor. You with me? I told you from the black church. Are you with me? Okay. The crisis would have a floor. It wouldn't just ripple forever and get very deep. But also, people don't recognize, because the economy is consumer-driven, it would also have an increased ceiling. I think there'd be an increase of 1% in GDP if America's economy, if Americans were financially literate. You have an increase of 1% in gross domestic product. One of the ways that China, the most populous nation in the world, right now can get ahead of the world economy and many places in Asia is by reaching, teaching, and empowering people at the lowest levels and as far out in the rural areas as you can get with basic tools of financial literacy education, free enterprise and capitalism, ownership, opportunity and entrepreneurship, and self-help. Because when you know better, you tend to do better. Policy. In the U.S., we are going to recommend, and by the way, the work of Operation Hope spurred President Bush earlier this year to sign an executive order making financial literacy the policy of the United States government. So out of a grassroots organization in South Central Los Angeles with a dream, in less than 15 years, was translated into a strategy for national policy in our government for the first time in well over 200 years. The first meeting of financial literacy happened in the Roosevelt Room in the White House in April of last year. The President signed the legislation on January 22nd of this year and created the President's Council on Financial Literacy, which is a bipartisan council. Chairman Charles Schwab chairs it, and I serve as Vice Chairman. I'm also Chairman of the Underserved Committee. I think that two things should happen. One, we should require that every child, and I heard one of the speakers this morning mention they went into a Chinese school to really amplify this, so this is important. But every child should receive a course in financial literacy education before what I would call eighth grade, and let's say by age 14, globally, period. This global economic crisis should teach us something, that we have to teach children and young people how the system works. If they're not part of the system, they'll see themselves as foreign to that system. They will be against that system. We've got to create individuals who believe they are a part of that system, stakeholders of that system, because the government of China, the government of Singapore, the governments of Canada, the governments of the United States do not have, we are seeing, enough money to throw at a problem when the problem is vast and gets its own momentum. We have got to give people the tools to empower themselves. Now let me go, in concluding my remarks, let me go to the last three P's. Products. In the mortgage lending industry in the U.S., subprime mortgages has become a dirty word. It's not a dirty word. There are great examples of responsible subprime lending, less than prime lending. The problem is greed-based subprime lending, predatory subprime lending, and fraud-based subprime lending, and no underwriting. We need to make sure that financial literacy education is part of the lending process, part of the application process, part of the review process. At every step of the mortgage process, there are opportunities to bring financial literacy into it, to raise transparency, and to increase the legitimacy of that loan portfolio. Credit cards. Right now, if you have a credit card, you're only communicated with by your lender, I'm sure not including Citi, by the way. You only communicate with your lender when you have bad news. Citi's credit cards actually are very good credit cards. They have some of these features. But they only communicate when you have bad news. When you don't pay, they talk to you. How about rewarding people for good behavior and not just bad behavior? So if you pass a certified financial literacy course, you get a credit on your balance of your credit card. If you pay consistently over time and never are late, the bank should reward you with a lower interest rate. We should be rewarding good behavior and not just penalizing bad behavior. Finally, programs. Nobody woke up this morning and said, "Ooh, I just can't wait to get a mortgage." Anybody in here woke up and said, "I want to get a mortgage. I just can't wait to get a high interest rate loan on my house." Anybody? Nobody wants a mortgage. They want to become homeowners. Nobody wants a bond. If you live in South Africa, you have a bond. You want to become a homeowner. Nobody wants a car loan. They want an efficient automobile. No one, maybe, other than an academic, really wants an education. They want what education can give them. It's aspirational. We work for things to be able to achieve a dream. Financial literacy has to be the same way. If you want to put a kid to sleep, give them a financial literacy course. Nobody cares. But if you want to excite that child, in America, the dropout rate in high school is 30%. The dropout rate in the urban inner cities is 50 to 75%. These statistics are also statistics you'll find around the world. Why are kids dropping out of high school? They don't believe education is relevant to their future. How do you make it relevant? Show kids how to do well and how to get rich legally. That's financial literacy, free enterprise and capitalism, ownership, opportunity, and entrepreneurship. Let's tie education to doing better in life. I'm going to end my formal remarks here now because I just wanted to sort of frame out a different way of looking at this issue. We have got to reinvent this industry. We have got to become relevant to the masses of people in this world. We've got to insert ourselves into the global debate about the future of free enterprise, capitalism, ownership, and opportunity. My hero is Andrew Young. He was Dr. King's right arm in the civil rights movement. We just recently wrote a letter to President-elect Obama, and we said, don't do financial literacy after your inauguration. Don't do financial literacy 6 months later. Don't do financial literacy 2 years into your administration. Don't do it. You need to start financial literacy education today. Because as you restructure the global economy, the U.S. policies impact the global economy, you have got to bring the consumer along with you. You've got to educate the consumer because they don't understand their own finances or the governments. One of the reasons that we rejected the $700 billion purportedly bailout package. You heard about this $700 billion bailout package. We rejected it initially because people didn't understand it. They thought it was a way of rewarding what they call rich fat cats on Wall Street. I had to remind consumers on television that this was actually about skinny cats on your street and not fat cats on Wall Street. That this is about the credit markets and lubricating the credit markets. But the consumers did not understand it. And it breeded resentment and distrust. So Obama in the U.S., your government here, governments in the United Kingdom, governments in Europe, governments in Asia, governments in Latin America, governments in the Middle East have to dual-track economic policy with financial literacy education at the same time to bring people along, to give them a stake in the system, to empower them, and to give them a choice. Thank you very much. I think that's an excellent question. I think that if you ask leaders in the civil rights movement what their movement was about, it was not about a black man sitting next to a white man at a lunch counter in Alabama. It was about a campaign for respect and dignity. I believe that the financial literacy is the civil rights issue of the 21st century around the globe. Without this vehicle, without financial literacy in a bank account, you cannot get to the other things that we aspire to. And so it's not about 2 + 2 = 4. It really is about respect and dignity. Embedded in dignity is the issue of ethics and values and integrity. One of the main problems in this global economic crisis, at its core, was that that we treated clients, major financial institutions, treated clients like transactions and not as relationships. I don't know if you got that. But when you treat a client like a transaction and not a relationship, you're concerned about today, but not concerned about tomorrow. You're concerned about your fee and your return, but you're not concerned about whether the borrower actually pays the loan back. And I think if we had given every loan as if it was our grandmother, if we had extended every loan as if it was somebody related to us, we would not have the crisis we have today. So you can do well and do good. Do well by doing good. Citigroup is one of the largest financial institutions in the world. But one of the reasons I believe that the world is rallying to Citigroup's support these days, and markets are up because of the support they're getting in the U.S., is because of things like the $200 million they committed to financial education over 10 years, their first major bank to make a commitment to financial education. We have over 1,000 Citigroup volunteers in classrooms teaching financial literacy. That creates brand equity in communities. It creates trust with consumers. It creates integrity and value in those consumers. And without consumer trust and confidence, banks are out of business. So I think that integrity is, this crisis is a confidence game. It went from a subprime crisis to a credit crisis to a liquidity crisis to a crisis of confidence. We have to restore the confidence of people, and at the core of that is ethics, values, integrity. And if you do those things, you'll make a lot of money. So you can do well and do good. So I think that's part of what I'm suggesting in this curriculum, is we need to radically reimagine how we approach financial literacy education, not as a math equation, but understanding it's personal to people.
Development
part of that.
So that's how
it is. Thank you very much.